History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, it's amazing how much we learn. We're always educated. We're always entertained. And inevitably, there's something there that can provide inspiration as we listen to memories from our men and women in uniform. Last time, we got you ready for VJ Day with memories from an ex-POW who was aboard the battleship Missouri when Imperial Japan's unconditional surrender officially brought World War II to a close. We also heard what President Harry Truman had said on that historic day, as well as General Douglas MacArthur's famous speech. And I told you that the National World War II Memorial would host a special ceremony commemorating that 81st anniversary. My guess is, though, that only a very small number of us actually got to hear a captivating speech on that 81st anniversary from one of roughly 30,000 remaining World War II veterans still living in America today. Before we hear from Dave Yoho, that veteran, here's how that commemoration in our nation's capital started.
Since 2007, Friends of the National World War II Memorial has worked to preserve this memorial, honor the legacy of the greatest generation, and ensure their service and sacrifice continue to inspire generations to come. Please welcome the chair of Friends of the National World War II Memorial, Mrs. Jane Dropa.
Good morning. It is an honor to be here today on behalf of Friends of the National World War II Memorial as we remember the end of World War II. On September 2, 1945, after years of war, sacrifice, uncertainty, loss, and victory, the fighting was finally over. For millions of Americans, it was a day of relief and hope. Families could begin to look towards reunions. Service members could begin to imagine coming home. And a world at war could finally begin the long journey towards peace. But that peace came at an extraordinary cost. It truly had been a worldwide war, as fighting took place on every continent except for Antarctica. It is estimated that 45 to 50 million civilians died, and 15 million military servicemen and women died. Roughly 16 million Americans served, which was about 12% of the population, and families across the country carried the burden of war alongside their enlisted men and women. They not only worried about their loved ones away from home, but they helped to build needed equipment, vehicles, and planes. They grew victory gardens and rationed gas, tires, rubber, sugar, coffee, meat, bacon, butter, fats and cooking oils, cheese, canned fish, canned milk, and shoes. More than 400,000 Americans gave their lives during World War II. That is why it matters that we gather here at the National World War II Memorial. This memorial was built to ensure that the service and sacrifice of the greatest generation would never be forgotten. Every stone, every star, every bronze, and every element of this place reminds us of the price of freedom and of our responsibility to remember. Friends is proud to work in partnership with the National Park Service in the care and preservation of this memorial so that it remains a fitting tribute to all who served and a place where future generations can come to learn, reflect, and remember. Their members and volunteers would be glad to answer any of your questions about the memorial after this ceremony. We are especially grateful to the families of World War II veterans who are with us today, and even more honored to have Dave Yoho, our World War II veteran, here. You all carry the stories forward in a deeply personal way, and your presence reminds us that the legacy of this generation lives on through the families and communities they shaped. Today we honor all who served. We remember those who never came home, and we give thanks for the peace their courage and sacrifice helped make possible. As the World War II generation grows smaller with each passing year, the responsibility to carry their story forward belongs to all of us. May this memorial always stand as a reminder of what they gave, what they achieved, and why we must never forget. Thank you for being here and for remembering with us.
Please welcome the United States Army Band, Pershing's Own Brass Quintet, performing a special musical tribute in honor of all of those who served during World War II and whose courage and sacrifice helped secure victory and preserve freedom.
Hear that ever-present rush of the World War II Memorial's signature fountain in the background, even as the music played there. But soon, it would be time to hear from a World War II veteran who is tireless in his efforts to preserve his generation's history so that future generations can learn from it.
We are honored to be joined today by World War II veteran, Mr. Dave, Mr. Dave Yoho, who celebrated his 98th birthday on August 19th. At just 16 years old, Dave enlisted in the United States Maritime Service and served aboard a T-2 tanker in the South Pacific. The war ended just 4 days before his 17th birthday. After the war, Dave earned his GED, attended night school, and built a remarkable career in business, eventually becoming a successful entrepreneur an internationally recognized speaker. 8 decades later, he continues to share his story and the legacy of his generation. Please welcome Mr. Dave Yoho.
Thank you, and with deep appreciation for those who stand up there and wonder what's going on and those who are passing by, and most of all to those of you who will listen to these messages today. I stand with behind me a sanctuary that provides education and knowledge, and moreover, an attempt to understand war. We entered the war and gave 16,200,000 people, men and women, uniforms. We served on 5 continents, all outside of the breadth of the United States of America. We lost 440,000 who died. And will you examine the history to find out about those that didn't die? And as you look at this wall bound here with the stars, and understanding that each star represents 100 of us who died, us, we were veterans. We were young, like your children, grandchildren. We had aspirations. But our country called us. We only had 130 million people, but if you examine the number of us that were under 20, and then examine when the war got desperate, they were under 18, under 17, and even towards the war end, they were recruiting for the United States Maritime Service, a 16-year-old. And then I want you to think about life through that vintage. And you may never be able to capture everything that's here if this is a casual admiration. If you instead search for the meaning of these things and what this ground means to us. This is holy, holy ground to us because it represents all of those who cannot speak for themselves. And I am fortunate to be in an age where there aren't too many of us left. We die, there are 40,000 of them estimated, and we die at the rate of 119 every day. But veterans of all classes, 23 take their lives every day because the truth of being a veteran is things happen to you that you don't want to talk about. You shared about your husband, your father, and how much they were willing to talk about it because it's about here. Because the unstung yet significant number of people who suffer post-traumatic stress, we can't correct it, can't even cure it. Can we understand it? And the World War II supposedly ended on August 15th. That's where I was in the Pacific, August 4th, 15th, 1945. And 4 days later, I turned 17. And then I mourn. I weep for those who cannot speak. And I weep for our educational system, which doesn't provide an understanding of what it is we went through. I was fortunate. I've been invited twice as a guest speaker in the D-Day. And this year I sat at the table with the producer, the director of a movie called Saving Private Ryan. And I said to them, there is one passage in there that is so significant. It deals with an old man kneeling at a cross, and he is searching for a name, and he weeps as he says these words in that film: did I lead a worthy life? Did what we did have significance? Did what we say and do today have significance? And the answer is yes, if you make it so. I'm going to be brief today because it's the sun. You notice I work without notes. God gave me this gift. I've made over 8,000 speeches all over the world, been to Congress about 7 times, been to the White House 4 times. And what do they get impressed by? My style, my use of language? I don't come here to express that to you. I come here to represent what all of these mean. And if you ever ask, what do the stars mean? One of these gentlemen will help you understand what the stars mean. And if you ask, why aren't they in alphabetical order? There's a significance on memory. And you're sitting on land that contains the sand and soil from every state in the United States. And these good people are very humble. Here now, I've known since he's taken this job. And his job is to deal with government and other political influences to get what is necessary to preserve what is so important to us. Now, I'll leave you with this. In earlier times, we didn't have subscription, there wasn't a draft. And the soldiers in old England 200 years ago marched into the town, and with the glare of the bagpipe, they sought out all men, all boys of a reasonable age to go to war. And there's a beautiful, beautiful hymn. And it wasn't translated to English until 1926. It's called O Danny Boy, because the original is London Derriere. But there's a passage in there that I would like you to remember. A father saying goodbye to a son. O Danny Boy, the pipes are calling. Tis you must go, and I must bide. And there's an interesting thing that I've taken the last quadrant of that, and I've taken some liberty to it, and I leave you with this, because the last part says, when you're in a place like this, think of someone in your life that you dedicate your time to today, and then you will be appropriately saying thank you to these people. Because the last passage says, should I return when the guns of war are silenced? and I am dead, as dead I well may be. Please come and find the place where I am lying and kneel and say an Ave, a prayer for me, and I will hear those soft you tread above me, and all my time within this tomb will be more significant. For if you come and tell me that you love me, then I will sleep in peace for all eternity. God bless this country. God bless the people who made it. And God bless the people who now propagate this for all the world to see. Carry our message forward. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
98-year-old World War II veteran Dave Yoho this past week at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to watch the entire ceremony, you can do that on the Friends of the National World War II Memorial website. When we come back, the story of someone who was there at that same location just one day earlier, thanks to the Honor Flight Network. It's that time of year again, and we'll expand on that thought when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We got to hear that impassioned speech from World War II veteran Dave Yoho this past week on the 81st anniversary of the end of the war. And that National World War II Memorial is going to be a very busy place for the next couple months as all volunteer groups from around the country take advantage of the fall weather in Washington, D.C. to send veterans to their memorials. Connect with the Honor Flight organization near you to find out when the next effort is taking place in your area. But the day before, Dave Yoho stood in front of the fountain. A group of 68 veterans from Central California were on that same hallowed ground. Many of them had fathers who served in World War II. One of them was even named for his uncle, who was one of the more than 400,000 Americans to make the ultimate sacrifice in World War II. But we're going to zero in on the story of a decorated Vietnam pilot who flew nearly 300 combat missions. And at about the same time Dave Yoho was speaking at the World War II Memorial, Smokey Rickard was joining three other veterans with Central Valley Honor Flight in laying a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. He's a recipient of the Silver Star and the Purple Heart, among other decorations, but becoming a pilot wasn't even on his radar growing up in Chowchilla, California.
You know, as a kid, you have a lot of aspirations, and one of those was being a pilot. But, you know, being a country boy and living on a ranch, all I ever thought that, I would grow up on the ranch and possibly go into agriculture, which is a great, great profession. And so I thought I was going to do that. I did play ball in high school, and then fortunately, I was able to play ball in college. And I was doing that, I thought, boy, what'd be great. I enjoy coaching, helping younger kids as I was growing up. So I thought, well, maybe one of these days I would be a coach. But no, when you're growing up, you never experienced or even thought that. And even though we were living close to Castle and Navy Lamar, no, there was never an idea that I would ever be a pilot.
Did you think you were going to be a pro football player?
Growing up as a kid, you always hoped that you had that quality. But as I got older, I didn't think I would ever be a pro football. I was looking for baseball. But at the same time, baseball and football was my two areas that I really loved. But as I was going forward, then with the draft coming in, it kind of stopped everything, you know, later on. So at that particular time, life ceased, you know, kind of like stopped back in the 69 type frame when it says you're going to have to go in the military. It's kind of like, whoa, wait a minute. I hadn't planned on that.
Well, let's talk about that because, I spent a lot of time talking to World War II veterans. For all of them, it was December 7th, 1941. It changed the world. And of course, they had a draft even before that, and guys knew they were going to be a part of this. So you're coming up in the 60s. You play college football for the Fresno State Bulldogs, and I'm sure you're planning your life out, right? You're saying, I'm going to do this and this and this and this. When did you realize that, hey, you could be snatched up and have to go halfway across the world to serve your country?
When you turn 18, you wind up going down and you sign up for the draft at that particular time, selective service. And then soon after that, you went in and you wound up taking a selective service, you know, physical and testing and stuff like that. And I think that became a kind of an eye-opener and stuff like that. And I had talked to my granddad who raised me, and my grandmother granddad, and he was World War I veteran, and we talked. And then my dad was World War II, and we talked about that, and of course with my uncle as well. And then, you know, I went ahead and I got married. We had a child. I was going to school and playing ball. And then all of a sudden, it says, I received a letter saying, welcome, you're in the United States. You've been drafted by the United States Army. That was really a big eye-opener at that particular time. So I went down to Madeira. That was my draft. And I said, you know, what are you doing? I'm in college. I'm married. I have a child. And they said, sorry, Smoke, you know, we're to the point now. Our requirements are start taking people like you. You know, married ones and stuff like that. So I decided I'd go down, and after thinking all different ways and what people were telling me, I went down and took the test for the Air Force and the Navy, Marines. And 5 o'clock the day I was supposed to left, the next day before Army, I got a call from Air Force says, hey, you know, we have an opportunity for you. Would you accept going to Officer's Candidate Training School? And then if you pass that, go on to be a pilot. And I said, a pilot? You know, I couldn't believe it. I said, absolutely, because Army had already told me that they were going to take me and put me in as a warrant officer, and I was going to be put in helicopters, and I was going to be sent to Vietnam. That's basically what they said. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, if I'm going to be a pilot, I might as well try to be a fixed-wing pilot and stuff like that. So I accepted that offer to the Air Force. So they gave me a delayed enlistment to finish my schooling. And so, I mean, that's when it kind of like everything turned away from being sports. And I knew what my life was going to be for the next few years. So I got my schooling done, and I graduated like in December, and I was in the military February.
Did you play football that fall?
No, I didn't have. I didn't have the opportunity. I was on the field. And then they said, hey, and I told the coach, I said, Coach, I'm sorry. I want to play, but I know what's going to happen if I don't get my schooling out of the way. So I went, got my education out of the way, and went on. So my heart was there. My heart was there all the time. But I had to think about my family and had to think about going into the military and what was best for that. So that's when you asked me that, it was like 69 when it says everything changed. My whole life changed. So.
Well, and that's what I wanted to get at, because you think about it today, and there are people listening right now who lived through this time, and there are those who didn't, and you think about college football today. And, I mean, it's a religion for some people. It's something you would never consider giving up this opportunity, but you were faced with that decision, and I'm sure you weren't the only guy on the team who was probably having similar concerns and thoughts. Do you remember how unsettling that time period felt?
Yeah, not only for myself, but for my wife and family. I mean, it was like, what do you mean you're going in the military? What do you mean that you're going to leave us? What do you mean that you know that you're going to wind up going over across the seas to possibly to war? It was like, what? I mean, my wife, I was 21, she was 18. And then when we had the baby, she was coming up on 20, and I was, you know, about 22, 23 years old. And in matter of fact, when I proposed to her, I said, how would you like to be a coach's wife? And she looked at me and says, who's going to be the coach? So, I mean, yeah, I mean, from then on, it, like I said, everything just changed.
You know, it strikes me, too, one of the reasons that this has been a touchy subject for so many decades is that there was such disagreement about whether or not Americans should be over there, what they were over there for, what you were trying to accomplish. Did you have a sense of that at the time, what you were going there for and what the mission or the overall task was?
Well, I think the main thing is you to be able to keep some type of sense to yourself and civility in you and thinking about logic. You had to think that, first of all, you're doing what the government is telling you. You're in the military right now. The military is saying, hey, you're going to be doing this, and it's for the good of the government, the good of the country. And so you had to think like that, or if not, you would go crazy. If you had a disparity between what you're believing in and what you're doing, you would wind up driving yourself crazy. So you had to believe in what you were being told and what your commanding officers were telling you to do and going forward and what your country says. So, yeah, I think, you know, you said yes, you believed in it when you went over there, and you wound up doing the very, very best you can. Knowing that it was a way, it was, again, it was another eye-opener when you wake up one day and kind of like, you know, United States, and then you maybe go to a foreign country, and especially Vietnam, and all of a sudden you wake up and you get off that airplane and you walk out there and things are so much different. I mean, buses are now look like, you know, no what, you know, with sandbags on the floor and barbed wire and wire on the side of the buses and over, you know, behind you and in the distance, you can hear artillery going off and stuff like that. You can catch yourself thinking, oh, that's just a training environment. But all of a sudden, how soon you realize it's not a training environment. And then you wake up and you say, where in the heck am I at? And how did I get here? Mm-hmm. So I think it's really a big wake up call between just like switching on a TV and off and on. It was really big.
Well, let's talk about the missions you were flying over there. What kind of aircraft were you flying, and what was the purpose of those missions?
I was a forward air controller. I was a FAC. And the main idea of the FAC was twofold, controlling all airstrikes and air power going into South Vietnam. We would go out there and we look for strike capabilities, also for, let's say, if you want to call us, use the bad guys, and if they were coming into South Vietnam to try to stop them, to interdict them, just looking for targets like that. And we were told the rules of engagement. We were told what you would be looking for, what we could and could not do, and you had to follow those rules. And so we were looking for anything to be able to help deter the advancement from the Viet Cong and also the North NVA, North Vietnamese Northern Army. I was flying the OV-10, OV-10 Bronco. It was a twin turboprop. We carried our own ordnance. We carried rockets, and we also carried four 7.62 miniguns, two on each side. And so if we could destroy or, let's say, deter the targets, we would. If not, then we would call in the fighters and stuff like that. And then I also had an exchange program with the Navy. I had a chance to fly off the USS Kitty Hawk, and I flew 15 missions in the F-4. So we had an exchange program. Then they came and flew with me in Da Nang and Pleiku and other places like that.
And on that OV-10, what's your crew?
One person, unless you're instructing or trying to welcome another one of your pilots, kind of like that, getting them trained into the area and stuff like that. Or if you were going to do artillery adjustment with the Marines or with our naval gunfires, we'd carry a Marine in the back or a naval controller in the back, which was called the Wolfman. And in between us putting in fighters, and they were putting in naval artillery, and then when we had the fighters come on, they would stop, and we'd put in fighters, and we'd keep going back. So it was kind of like touch-and-go type things.
So in a lot of ways, you're on your own.
We are. We were.
And you're kind of the front line in the air, right? Scouting it out?
Correct. That's exactly right. We were the ones out there in the forward of everybody trying to look and check and try to find targets and be able to understand where everybody was at. So we knew that lay of the land like the back of your hand. We got to the point that, I can say for myself, I became to start like playing sports. You start thinking like them, acting like them, and start thinking like them, and I started getting to the point that I became very, very good at identifying camouflage. And so from a distance, I could, you know, I could pick up underwater bridges or, you know, where they had their POL storage location. So, yeah, I mean, you started getting to know the land. If it changed one thing or another, you got to know. So it was interesting.
And what were the dangers you faced? I know that's a lot of missions that I'm kind of muddling together there, but in general, what were the kind of potential dangers you faced?
Well, I think, of course, several of them there. You could wind up artillery, of course, ground artillery, missiles. Those were your biggest ones. You'd get into areas that you maybe not see the missiles. Of course, a lot of them were heat-seeking, so you didn't see until after, corkscrew. Unless you happen to be seeing the flash or whatever the case may be. Of course, the AAA, the artillery. What scared me the worst was the fast-forward ordnance, rapid firing, like the 51 cals, 23s. But you'd still get some big ones. A lot of times they would have the AAA that would get you high, and then they'd drive you down low. And then once they got you down low, then they would try to hit you with the 23s and 51s, the smaller rapid-firing ones. And then here again, if you got down low enough, of course, too, in that area, then you're also looking for the heat-seeking Strela handheld devices that could knock you down and go into your engine, stuff like that, or any portion that would be able to seek the heat from your aircraft. It could knock you down, it could destroy you, or hit you just right, or what'll happen, you would wind up maybe with one engine less and trying to get home. So there was a lot of, the opportunity like that. Same way for your fighters when you're bringing them in. Same thing was happening to them. They had the same concerns about being shot down that way.
Well, and as I hear you describe that, it occurs to me that you have such a strong grasp and inventory of those hazards because you probably saw each one of those hazards claim an airplane.
Yes.
Whether it was yours or somebody else's.
Yes.
And you're taken to the skies on every one of these missions knowing that you've got a wife and a child back home. How hard was that to do, to take off from one of those missions with that knowledge in the back of your head?
You really had to forget it. You really had to forget and keep your mind on what was happening because after you got down and you could thank God that you made it home okay, you wind up having to forget that you have a wife and child because it would just drive you crazy. And you got homesick. You really, really got homesick. So during that particular time, if you got your mind somewhere else and not into the game, so to speak, you could wind up, they were after you. I mean, that's what they were doing. They were after you because the forward air controllers, the Coveys, the FACs, the Rustics, the Sundogs, so there was a variety of airplanes that were doing the same thing. Some put into a lower threat area, some, the OV-10 was in the high threat area. If you wasn't watching what you're doing, they were after you and they would be trying to get you down. As a matter of fact, what was also ironic, they had bounties. They knew our call signs and stuff like that and got to know us just like we got to know some of them on the phone. But when they would actually pop up and start talking. But they knew us, and there was some, intel that was taken that they had big, high rewards on if you could get certain FAC or whatever down. They got paid reward. Well, whatever the reward was, I don't know.
What was your call sign?
I was Covey 566, and then we changed from 566, depending on where you flew out of. I was 566, Covey 266, and then we just dropped it later on, just was 66.
But you would have the enemy find your frequency
and actually speak English to you? Absolutely. We would have a conversation, if you want to call it that, and of course, we had homing devices. Some of us had homing devices in our aircraft that home in on there. As long as we keep them key in the microphone, we could home in and know exactly where they're at and see what we could do about ending their transmission.
So what would those conversations be like? I mean, this is like trash talk on the football field, like baseball diamond?
It was actually trash talk. Oh, yeah. Sometimes they really got personal because they got to know that you knew so-and-so. And there was a couple of times they would come up and they'd say, hey, Covey 66 or 566, we're going to shoot you down like we did your roommate or like we did your other Covey or whatever the case may be. And, it tried to get your name, your mind out of the game to get you to do something stupid and start not think about what's really going and get you kind of like that black widow in the web, so to speak. And there was transmissions constantly either trying to be jammed or interfered with or come on to. So even Army, Navy, and Air Force and Marines, somewhere along the line, they had a chance to talk to a few of those same ones, too.
So when you say that the enemy's trash talk included things like, we're going to do you like we did your roommate, I mean, that tells me that there were things that happened to other pilots that you knew very well. What are some of those things that you had to endure happening to the guys you had been serving with?
There was 13 individuals from my outfit while I was over there that didn't come back. matter of fact, five of them were roommates of mine, and then one of them came back as a POW. You know, it's you're gonna have you have to trick yourself, you know, into thinking that okay, you know, Art's not here or Bruce is not here or Steve's not here because he went somewhere else or he went home. Because you did grieve. You did grieve for a while. You did, you know, you went to a place by yourself and shed a tear, you know. But it was really, really hard. And trying to get over it, you know, it was very challenging, you know, to say the least. And some of them even came back, you know, their names or about them came back, you know, 40 years later, you know, when you see their family. And, you didn't realize that was going to happen. No, there was several of them, and a lot of them I felt I have, you know, I still have problems with because I became the chief scheduler, and the ones that went down, I scheduled them for that mission. And so what really makes you, you know, what would happen if I hadn't put them on that particular mission? What happened if I'd have put them on another mission, or maybe if I'd have taken a mission, that mission myself? And, you know, you start talking to yourself, you know, you start second-guessing yourself, but after a while you just have to say, you know, there's nothing you can do, you just got to go on, or it would drive you crazy.
It's time for our final break, but the most harrowing moments of Smokey Rickard's time in uniform will be related in vivid detail when we come back. Pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for a video of Smokey at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall this week, remembering some of the men he just referenced. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, college football is in full swing this weekend, and the man we've been hearing from, Smokey Rickard, thought he was going to be playing college football in 1969. Instead, Uncle Sam came calling. And as he laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier this week as part of his honor flight experience, as he looked up each name of a fallen brother on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall, he couldn't help but reflect on how close he came to being one of those 58,000 names.
You know, it was, like you said, you know, how many was in that airplane usually? And I said one. No, there was actually two. The good Lord was in the back seat. He was my co-pilot. And the reason why I say that is I had come back from a mission. I was down at Saigon at that time, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City. I just walked in from a mission, and I put my bags down. Well, all of a sudden, I heard one of our radios going just crazy. We had Army frequencies, Marine frequencies that, you know, let us know. They started hollering when they were having problems or being overrun. So I, you know, they were saying, you know, the code. And so I got on and I talked to them and they said, yeah, we're being overrun and we need some help. And we always kept a couple airplanes completely fueled and loaded up as an emergency. So I called the commander and I said, hey, we got a call. We got to go down south. We've got a, you know, a code. And he says, Smoke, can you handle it? Because you just got through the one. I said, oh, no. I said, we haven't got time. I'm going to go and I'll talk to you when I get down there. And there was some other guy, you know, some of our other guys, and there are other areas out there, but not primary for that. So I got in the airplane. I took off down there. Well, when I got down south, it was about 200 miles from Saigon towards the tip of South Vietnam down the Delta area. And I get there to the outpost, and I see the bad guys going underneath the wires, over the wires, and they kind of have a three wires perimeter fencing, and they were in a triangle type thing, and they were going under and over and stuff like that. So I wound up, keep your head down, and I, you know, loaded up, and I started going one side, down the other side, and all three sides, and, you know, there was nothing there. There was no trees or anything. It was completely clear except the bob, you know, the fencing and stuff like that, constituted wire, and how they wound up making the perimeter fences. So after about two or three runs on each side, I didn't have to do any more. I just kind of waited back, and I called and asked for fighters to come in to help take out another area. And so being there, I'm talking to the Army, letting everybody know that, hey, everything's fine now, and we're trying to calm them down. And all of a sudden, I'd run them back into the tree line, and I'm waiting, and then all of a sudden, the tree line fell, a false tree line fell. And next thing I know, they had a new piece of equipment down there. It was a quad-mounted 51 cal with arming piercing rounds, and it was coming up, and they looked like pumpkins coming up. And I did something stupid. Like I said, falling into it. I was low and I was slow. I wasn't high and keeping my speed up. So anyway, I tried to start moving back and forth, changing my altitude, changing my direction stuff. We called it jinking, so that maybe they wouldn't be able to hit me. Well, all of a sudden, I went one way, and then I came back, and all of a sudden, what passed my head? One of the rounds came in. Next thing I knew, it blew up inside, took all the canopy. I became blind. I couldn't see, and I hear a noise going off my ears, Pete, that the engine and everything was on fire, and I could start seeing the red lights. I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, and I got to keep my head. And I remembered that the reason I knew that I could remember how I could get away from them, because you could hear it just the shells was hitting me from the tip, and I could just hear them running right down again. So I remembered that there was only one way out, and that was behind them. And so I thought the only way I can do is turn it upside down, shoot some rockets to keep their heads down, but I can't see, but I've got to do something, because if I try to run away from them or go left and right, they're going to shoot me down. So I turned it upside down, and I shot some rockets at them. As it started getting dark in the cockpit, I said, I'm pretty close to the ground. So I flipped it back over at that particular time, and as I did, I started to bring it back up. I ran into the trees. I had enough momentum to get me through the top of the trees, and I did bring tree limbs back with me. But I had enough. I was able to start. Well, they couldn't swing their guns around to be able to hit me from the rear at my 6 o'clock. So I climbed back up, and I called. Well, just within maybe 5 minutes after I called, to the other, my buddies from the other, you know, from my squadron, jumped on me, and they said, Smoke, you're going to have to jump out. You're smoking. You're burning up. And I said, no, I'm not going to jump out. I said, I'm either going to take it home, or we'll see what does happen, but I'm not going to jump out. So anyway, they said, well, what can we do? You know, and I said, I can't see. So what I need for you to do, you just let me know if I'm start on fire. I said, just let me know that I'm on fire, and then I will dive it, try to put out the flames, and I'll climb back up. And I said, my gear is down. They said, well, your gear is down. Your cockpit is completely gone. And I said, I know that. I can feel that. And I said, how far we got to go? And they said, about 200 miles. I said, okay. So I said, just let me know, and we'll keep going. Of course, the gas was running out because we had wet wings. So that's what I did all the way. And, of course, they told me several times, they said, Smoke, you got to jump out of there. And I said, no, I'm not going to bail out. So we get back to Saigon, and the ground, you know, the ATC got a hold of me, and they started guiding me, and they knew I couldn't see. So they cut me down over the runway, and they said, your gear down, and so God bless and good luck. And so I touched down, and I didn't know if the gear was going to hold, so I hit on one side gear, and it did. I did on the other side, and it did. And then I said, I just put the nose down and stepped on the brakes and stuff like that. Well, my roommate, he had heard, and he wanted to get an airplane to come help me out, and they said no. He had a Jeep, and he was right. All I see was a blur. I didn't know what it was, but it was right beside me. And when I stopped it, I was like, then that's when everything hit me. He comes running over there, and now we're taking a sniper attack. Snipers are shooting at us and stuff like that. So he gets me out. The ambulance wouldn't get there, you know, couldn't come there because they're being shot at. So he pulls me out, puts me in his Jeep, and he takes me back to the ambulance and puts me in there. So after looking back at it, it was like, thanks God, I knew you were my back seat. I just, you know, I don't know, you know.
We've all heard that expression, flying blind, but I think you just gave it new meaning. What does that feel like to land a plane and you literally can't see anything?
You know, you look back now, and I think one of the main things was being, you had to keep, and of course, you knew what was happening. You know, you felt yourself, you kept saying, well, that's just sweat. That's all it is. It's just sweat. And you knew what it was, but you couldn't let your mind start drifting.
It's
and you
blood had, running down your face.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And you had to keep yourself, where am I at right now? What altitude? You had to literally be very, very, stay on track. And thank God you were a fairly good pilot to be able to do that and to be concentrating on what was happening. Because if you start getting disoriented, if you start straying off, you'd wind up crashing because you'd be disoriented and you couldn't see anything. So you just had to know. And thank God, I mean, my two guys there that was on my side kept and, you know, keeping me up to breath. I mean, that really helped me out because of being able to talk. But then one of them, then also what happened, one of them took off, Tom took off, and he went back to the site when the fighters came in, and he went ahead and eliminated the threat from helping it to anybody else in that area. When you got down and your mind started thinking about what happened and laying there in a hospital and stuff like that, it was like, wow. It just like, wow. You just come tumbling down after it was all over with.
How long did it take before you could see again?
It was probably a good 2, 3, 4 days, and we were hoping everything would come about. I didn't tell my wife. Matter of fact, it was like 4 or 5 months, and I met her in R&R in Hawaii, and my roommate JD, who was with me, and we were eating one night, and of course, started having a couple of drinks, and he started telling the story about what happened and everything like that. And then all of a sudden, my wife realized he was talking about me, and he didn't know that I had not told her. Oh, my goodness. Needless to say, I thought I was going through another war. But she said, why didn't you tell me? I said, I didn't want you to worry. You know, so, but, you know, at that time, I said, okay, Smoke, you're able to go home. And I said, no, I'm not going home. I'm going to stay right here and finish my tour. So I went back and continued flying and finishing my tour.
But you did receive the Purple Heart for that mission?
Yes, I did.
Any other decorations for that mission?
I got the Distinguished Flying Cross, and then there was also a silver medal that was put in. But again, through fire and stuff like that, there was some. But anyway, it never went through, which is fine. And then also I got the, matter of fact, I had the South Vietnamese President Van Thu to bring over, and I got the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with a silver star for that, helping that, because there was also Republic of Vietnam Army in there with them too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was one of those things. But here again, I don't know too many people that did anything for awards.
Well, I'm not saying you did it for the awards.
No, but here again,
but they
yeah.
gave you the awards because you saved a lot of lives, and it almost cost you yours.
Well, yes, to answer your question, yes.
And one more question on that before we talk more about your wife who you just mentioned. What do you think would have happened to you if you listened to your buddies and you had bailed out when you were blind and flying that thing?
I know what would have happened. I wouldn't have been here today. I don't even know if I would have been able to even hit the ground alive. The reason why I say that, I saw that firsthand putting in a A6, one of those Navy intruders. We were doing a mission one evening, if you want to call it that. And I said, hey, there's no friendlies here. Take random headings, you know, and everything like that, and I'll clear your hot when I see which way you're going. So about the second or third time, one of them kept going the same way. Pretty soon I saw one of his wings, his right wing, fly up over top of his canopy, and then just a few minutes later, both of them ejected. But I was on top of them trying to talk to them, and there was no response, no nothing. So as they were coming down, they were just a target. So, no, I know. I know that's the reason I said, how do I want to do it? And I always told my wife that I will never be a POW. I will always either escape, or I will, but I'll never be a POW. And so that's the way I looked at it then, is I'm not jumping out. So the good Lord, I guess the good Lord is with me at that particular time.
And the reality is, as you describe it, I'm thinking not only would you have been shot, your remains probably never would have been recovered. And your family might have even had unanswered questions still
mm-hmm.
today.
Because mm-hmm.
that's the reality for a lot of families still.
Absolutely.
All these years later.
Absolutely.
But you mentioned your wife, and she had her own war to fight back here in the States while you were over there risking your life. What do you understand now about what your young bride and young mom to a little toddler at the time was going through?
When I went over there, I also asked the Air Force, I said, hey, can you give me 30 days? My wife's pregnant with our number two child. Can you give me 30 days? And I don't mind going over there. I'm going to be here with my wife to have it. So now 20 days later after go that she's had the baby. I didn't see it until it was almost a year old. So with that being said, with the wife, I didn't realize a lot of that stuff happened. She didn't tell me. She didn't write me. She didn't let me know. I didn't know about it until afterwards. But also heard many horror stories about other families and stuff like that, but I didn't realize it happened to mine. But here in the local community, believe it or not, and I still shake my head, like a lot of other communities, once they found out that you were in, you know, were military and overseas in Vietnam, a lot of times if your family was around, they got harassed. And that's what happened to mine. Neighbors and stuff like that found that I was overseas and I was a pilot. They come knocking on the door at my wife's apartment to where she was at, and my little girl, my daughter too at that time, and my wife went to the door, and they started saying, "Do you know your husband's overseas killing and maiming children and women?" And of course, my little girl, my daughter, Lisa, she looked up and said, "Mommy, is that what Daddy's doing?" And she says, "No," and she shut the door. Well, it got to the point that she came back one evening, and there was stuff written on the door, front door. And so that's when she called her mother and dad and says, "Hey, you know, I've got to move out of here." So they moved her out of there and boom, moved her to a new location. And she tried to keep that low key that about me being overseas. So I didn't find about that. I felt so terrible that she had to endure that, something that it was me. I really feel, you know, like I said, remember I was telling you about families and stuff like that? She still remembers that. And she still remembers how it wasn't pretty, you know, what was going on, especially trying to figure out why we were doing this, you know. So she had some trouble with it as well. And I just hope that United States never allows this country, allows this to ever happen again, to a bunch of military men and women to go off and come back and make them feel like worth something less.
It may not be possible to fully right that wrong, but this week, when Smokey Rickard returned on a significantly delayed honor flight to find not only his wife and other family members, but another 1,000 well-wishers waiting for him more than a half century later, a very different message was sent and received. Here's how it sounded among the giant sequoias at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport. Those cheers continued until every one of those veterans made it all the way through an extended human tunnel, creating a moment that none of them will ever forget. And there will be scenes like that unfolding at airports all around America in the weeks ahead. So go to honorflight.org to connect to a group near you and find out how you can support that cause. That's all the time we have today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.